The way I like to keep track of who comes and who doesn't is by passing out, like in the United Nations, you know, you have a little card that says who you are as a delegate from, the honorable delegate from so-and-so. I do this so partially because it's the way I can most efficiently get to know your names. So just to warn you, everybody has their weak points, right? So even if you're the world's most brilliant scholar, there's some part of your brain that doesn't work well. The part of my brain that doesn't work well is names. And getting older hasn't helped that part. You know, it's not that practice makes perfect. It's just that I'm sort of nominologically challenged. So I'm really terrible with names. But I'm a good reader. And so the way I get names deeply embedded is by having the index. So we'll pass these out each time. Also, there's this is a cultural fact, that women change their hairstyles more frequently than men do. And if you want to make it hard for me to remember your name, the best trick is to do dramatic changes in the kind of configuration, because that confuses my attempts at creating anchors. So this is not, it's not a course requirement that everybody wear the same clothes all semester, keep the same hairstyle, but if you want to make life easy for us nominologically challenged folks, then don't do dramatic changes without warning me. Okay, I will pass these around. I'll say them, if you sort of raise your hand, and it will get past you. So, and this is also a way to introduce your names to everybody else in the class as well. So Tatiana. You pass this to Tatiana. Daniel Block. Adam Brehan. Adam, is that in here yet? Paulina Kalfukoy. Okay, so I'll put these here so when they... David Kalinitsky. David. Daniel Cox. Daniel. Madeline Fairbairn. Also, if I mispronounce your name or you prefer a nickname to whatever, I just took these off of the roster. Just let me know. Jacob Gelb. Tylan Akar. Is it Talon or?
It's Tylan.
Tylan?
Yeah.
Alex Hannah. That's Alex. Adam Harry. Matthew Kearney. You go by Matt or Matthew?
Matt.
Matt, okay. Joseph Koss.
Joe is fine.
Joe? Okay. Gary Southkramer. Yifei Li.
Yifei.
Yifeng Li.
Lilfeng.
Li.
That will take us a number of corrections before I get it in my ear. So. Donald Malchow.
What's wrong?
What? Is that
my father's name should be L-I-N.
Oh, okay. Okay, I see it is correct here. I don't know how it got changed on here. So, okay. Correct it on there, because I'll collect these back at the end, and then I'll make you a new one for next time. Mehreen Malik?
Mehreen, that's me.
And how do you pronounce it?
Mehreen.
Mehreen.
Malik.
Malik. Rachel Miller? Yotaro Natani? Alids Oshhagen. Alids. Zhao Pachansky. Daniel Suarez. Lindsay Twin. And Aicha Zayin.
Aicha.
Aicha?
Perfect.
Aicha. Aicha Zayin. Okay. Is anybody who's on the, any of these people come in yet?
Yeah.
And you are?
Derek.
Okay. Well, I suspect that some people are wandering about trying to find the place. Before I give you the go through the syllabus and tell you requirements. Hi, what's your name here? Are you one of these guys?
No, I'm trying to maybe audit the course.
Okay, so just come on in, and we'll take what we'll do today is in the break in the middle. Anyone who isn't a regular signed up student yet and wants to discuss possibilities. Just come and see me, and we'll work out the details about how to proceed with that. Before I go through the details of the requirements and give some introductory comments to try to set the stage for the class, even though I've said everybody's name, even though it's a big group, I think it's still worthwhile to very quickly go around. Don't just give sort of name, rank, and serial number, as it were. Give your name and just say if you're an undergraduate or a graduate student. There's about a 2-to-1 ratio of grad students to undergrads in the class. Hi, are you one of these characters here?
Not.
Yeah, so you are?
I'm Adam.
Adam.
Right, but I hear about him.
Yeah, Adam, and you are?
I'm David.
David.
I emailed yesterday.
Yeah, so I don't have a name card for you.
No.
Okay, so just come on in and we'll worry about that later. So, tell us your name and your sort of academic standing, but then say something about what brings you to this course, just a sentence or two. It doesn't have to be a profound and elaborate comment, but just something about what you're hoping for, what your background is, or what your interests are, and the sorts of material that we'll be discussing. So, Adam, why don't you?
All right, I'm Adam. I'm a undergrad, senior, it's my last semester, and I'm a history and political science major, and what brings me to this class is I'm a leftist and an activist, and I like to be well-read when it comes to theory, so here I am.
My name is Jorge. I'm originally from California, Chicano by birth and personal decision, and Mexican by origin. I'm a first-generation student here in the United States. I'm studying education, curriculum, and instruction. I'm a starting my second year PhD. And I'm interested in the course because generally this has been embedded in my life throughout. And so I want to specifically study cultural studies. And I want to see how Marx influenced cultural studies.
Hi everyone. I come from China. I am a new graduate student in Department of Sociology. What brings me to this class is I love Marx. That's
My name is Matt. I'm a new graduate student in sociology. And situated in terms of the readings for today, I describe my interest as I care about whether or not there's a middle class, but what really keeps me up at night are methodological, theoretical issues about whether the role of subjectivism in understanding historical research and the role of adjudication and the legitimacy of adjudication, that kind of broad theoretical question. So I try to use those. I'm interested in understanding how empirical research can drive the understanding of those questions as much as possible. That's why I'm here.
My name is Daniel. I'm in the second year in the sociology department, PhD. And I decided to take this course because I think that if you do sociology, it's one of the core courses to take. And then I was actually positively surprised by the analytical approach, which I just was not aware of when I signed up. That's me.
My name is Yotaro. I'm a first-year graduate student in the sociology department. And I'm taking this course because generally I'm very interested in Marxism, but also I'm interested in exploring the moral and normative commitments that drive Marxists to activism and fighting against exploitation.
My name is Joe. I'm a special student. I have an undergrad degree, and now I'm in the School of Ed getting a teaching certificate in high school social studies. So my undergrad degree was in philosophy and political science, but I did a lot of political theory, political philosophy, egalitarian theory that really got me interested. And I know Harry Brighouse fairly well, and he always spoke very highly of Eric, so that's why I kind of one of the reasons why I'm here.
My name is Marco. I'm a graduate student at the political science department, and I'm interested in labor unions, so Marxism and labor unions is a kind of a natural connection there.
My name is Aita. I'm also a first-year graduate student in sociology, and what brought me here is that basically I find Marxism as an important tool to understand the world and basically possible to change it.
I'm Alex. I'm a first-year graduate student in sociology. I was drawn to this class because I'm familiar with various strains of Marxism and interested in this kind of take on it. And I'm interested also in social movements and how developing a theory of emancipation or trying to explain such can be an role in liberation movements.
I'm Tatiana, and I'm also the first year of the graduate program in sociology at the sociology department. And it is because I'm not coming from a Marxist tradition, but I'm interested in inequality in general and in class and class analysis. So I think it's important to take in and just look for some alternatives to change our relationship.
That's it. My name is João. I'm from Brazil. I'm a second year graduate student in the sociology department. And I'm interested in that class as a way to understand how theory and Marxism, not specifically, can actually be a tool to change the world.
My name is Tyler. I'm a first-year grad in sociology department. I'm interested in class state, so-called neoliberal state in the new era. And I would like to also encourage it with the tension between the commitment and scientific methods.
My name is Dan. I'm a first-year grad student in the sociology department. And I've always been pretty interested in the ideas Marx forwarded, but in my undergrad institution, Marxism was, you know, a dirty word, net worth, and completely ignored best. So this really represented for me my first chance to actually get a little deeper into a lot of these ideas that seem so interesting and logical.
I'm Meryn Malik. I'm a now third year graduate student in the Department of Political Science. My interests broadly are democratic theory, political Islam, political theology, and I read a lot of continental philosophy, and Marx keeps coming up, even though, you know, the methodological thrust is very different. But I'm taking this class because I thought it was time to sort of study Marx in a more disciplined, systematic way. So that's basically it.
I'm Gary. I'm an undergrad student. Major is linguistics, German, Russian. I'm taking this class because, well, first off, it's a class that I can take to fulfill a credits for German, but...
For German?
Yes.
Because Marx is German?
I
insist that you read everything in German.
I've been reading a lot about socialism and Marxism, the Marxist tradition, and I found it really interesting, and what I wanted to do was approach it more from an empirical standpoint as opposed to just reading it and saying, okay, yeah, I can read everything that's, you know, so obviously in this class would be a perfect class.
Hi, my name is Cynthia. I'm from Russia. I will be there only for a month, and we read the professor in Argentina. I am a PhD student there, and my research is the theory I use to my research is Marxism. So I want to be here only for a month, but I think it will be a nice experience.
My name's Don. I'm an undergraduate junior student, and I'm studying to be a history teacher, hopefully. I'm just kind of interested in Marx, and I guess it came from a recommendation from a professor that actually, or a graduate student that actually left, so that's why I'm here.
My name is Yifei, a first year graduate student in the Department of Sociology, coming from China. I'm here in this course because I have a specific set of questions, like socialism in China isn't really the socialism that Marx actually described. I'm just wondering what kind of socialism we can construct from Marxism.
My name is Daniel. I am also a junior undergrad. I have a lot of interests sort of related to Marxism, especially social democratic politics in Northern Europe and developer state.
My name is Lindsay. I'm a graduate student from the Department of Sociology. I'm here because I wanted to build a groundwork of critical theory, a framework of critical theory in Marxism, looking at how people explore the questions raised by Marxism and also seeing what its role is in academia and in the world.
My name is Madeline, and I'm a fourth-year grad student in sociology. And I've actually finished all my required courses and then realized I managed not to take any classes with Eric, and know shockingly little about Marxist theory. So, which is very relevant to my work. I am interested in resistance in the world food system and global trade in agricultural goods especially. So I thought it was about time.
My name is Rachel. I'm a senior undergrad. I'm studying political science and also Russian, Eastern European, Central Asian history. So, this is also a requirement for that, but I thought that of all the courses I could take, it seemed really interesting. I don't know a lot about Marxist theory. I haven't studied a lot of theory, even though I'm a political science major, so it's a good way to learn.
My name is Adam. I'm a second year PhD student in the curriculum instruction, and a lot of my research that I'm looking at is going towards applying critical theory and critical pedagogy and stuff to classrooms and using democratic school methods and things like that. Paulo Freire, a number of other different people that have drawn on Marxism in some pretty significant ways, and this was a good way for me to sort of get deeper into that and see how it impacts my research and work in schools. So.
Yeah, my name is David. I'm a PhD student in the European University Institute in Florence. So I'll be here, I'm at the law school as a researcher for the semester. And I'm writing about legal reasoning in the specific context of the EU, where we have a problem of contested supremacy. And I'm taking this seminar, this course, because I also want to deal in the last part of my thesis with possible institutional innovations. So to have a background of Marxist theory of analytical Marxism and to know a bit better the tools, I think would be helpful.
I'm Paulina Calfucoy. I'm a second year student in the PhD in Development Studies. I'm taking this class because I'm interested in the state, and in particular the state after neoliberalism. And I want to know more about the Marxist tradition and the discussion about the state.
Hi, I'm David. I'm interested in Marx and Marxism because I'm interested in changing the world. Like maybe some other people here, okay. But I'm specifically coming from economics and am specifically interested in Marxian political economy and have traditionally been interested in the comparison between political or the questions that political economy can answer as opposed to, say, neoclassical economics. And I'm taking this class because, well, I'm here because I'm trying to do Marxism in general. I'm here in Wisconsin. I want to do this sort of thing, I guess.
Well, this is an extraordinary cast of characters here in this class. Every year when I teach this course and then we all introduce each other, it renews my sense of why I'm doing this. So I'm very grateful that you're taking this class. The usual expectation around teaching is, of course, that the professor is doing some service to students. Of course, I hope to help you in developing your own ideas. I cannot say strongly enough what you do for me in a class like this. I've just finished a book this summer, which I've been working on very intensively for the last 5 years, but the pedigree of this book goes way back, you know, before that, called Envisioning Real Utopias. And there is nothing which has shaped the ideas of that book more than teaching this particular course. Teaching it iteratively, that is teaching it many times, with new cohorts of students, struggling to make things clear and to see where things aren't clear, as well as, of course, sometimes getting specific objections that I have to counter and so on. All of that has very deeply shaped the way I think about the problems that we're discussing. And I'm not, I'm saying this now, you're kind of hearing it. What I hope by the end of the semester you'll understand is that I really mean it, that it's true. As my children, when they were little, used to say, this is a true fact, right? There is no better way to learn something than to teach it. Those of you who will become professors will learn that. When you finish your PhDs and begin as an assistant professor, that's not the end of your education. That's the beginning of the most demanding and interesting part of your education, if you take the task of teaching seriously. So I'm grateful that you're all here. This is bigger than it's been for many years. I'm excited about that as well. It's also been the case that this is, as I think, if you've looked through the syllabus, you know, this is taught as a graduate student course, but I always have undergraduates in it. And then as a collectivity, we take responsibility for being sure that undergraduates don't feel marginal and at a disadvantage through the various devices we use to be sure that the undergraduates are fully engaged. Well, in recent years, it's been almost exactly 50-50. And the typical class size for this course has been around 18 students, 9 graduate students, 8 or 9 undergraduates. A couple of years there were more undergraduates taking it than graduate students. It hasn't been like this since the early 80s. I don't think I've had a class with, I think there's roughly 20 graduate students and 6 or 7 undergraduates, more or less that seems the ratios as I see it. Now, I don't know if that's just because the economy is bad and more people are going to graduate school. Particularly leftist graduate students, maybe, but for whatever reasons, I think this will be extremely exciting because of the energy and the sophistication that is being brought to the table. Okay, let me give some words about the character of the class, how I'm going to run it, or how we're going to collectively create it. And then some specifics about requirements and other matters of that sort. The one complaint that students have often made about this course is that there's not enough time for real debate and discussion in the class. So I always, at the beginning of the year, say that I really want there to be lots of intense discussion, but then I end up talking too much. And it's, I don't think it's because I just like to hear myself talk. It's because I get excited about the material, I want to be sure everybody understands what I'm saying, and I go on too much. Go on too much because a lot of what I say repeats things that are in the readings rather than refines issues through discussion. So what I tried as an experiment the last time I taught it, but I want to do it more rigorously this time, is to put the lecture notes for the class on the course website before the classes meet. And then to have as an absolutely strong expectation that you've read those lecture notes. This doesn't work if you don't read them ahead of time. So the lecture notes, the way it's structured on the class website is all the lecture notes from the previous time I taught the course are organized and renumbered so they correspond to the sessions this time, with the date 2008 behind them. As I revise them, which is usually, you know, in the week or a few days before the actual class, I then move them up to the 2009 section and relabel them. I don't anticipate there being dramatic changes in the content of these lecture notes. I've worked on this so many times. They do change, but so it may happen for some of the lectures that I don't actually do much or any revision before I promote them, so to speak, to the 2009 slot. If your timing is such that it makes sense for you to read those lecture notes before I have revised them, I don't think that's going to be a problem. You know, whatever I add is not going to change anything about the central ideas and point of a given lecture. There are a couple of sessions which are new this time for which there aren't previous year's lectures, and I'll try to be sure to get those, at least something, prepared ahead of time so that you'll be able to read it. So, the routine is, whatever else you do, read the lecture notes. I know it's impossible for everybody every week to have read all of the required readings for a session. It's, you know, people have lives and things come up. You'll have exams that are going to just simply make it impossible at particular times to do the readings. Whatever you do, do not skip reading the lecture notes. Then I will come into class with that full expectation, and then I think I can reduce my comments to the half-hour-ish range, half hour, 40 minutes, where I simply talk about a few of the points in the lecture that I think I want to really emphasize and explain verbally. It is not entirely redundant to explain something verbally that you have read, even if there's no, on the surface, different content, because we take things in differently when we hear them than when we read them. I mean, this is a basic cognitive psychology point about learning. It's both because of individual variations. Some of you are extremely good auditory learners, better than you are readers. I know you all know how to read very well, but in terms of when things really click and you really get it, the spoken language is not the same as the written language because we modulate our tone, we emphasize things, we use hand gestures, there's no hand gestures in the writing. There's all sorts of ways in which verbal communication is different and gets internalized in the brain differently. It gets recorded differently. Different parts of the brain deal with these things. So it's not entirely redundant. What I'll do then is focus on the things which I really most feel need some elaboration or some repeating, but I'll really keep it down to that shorter chunk. And that will give us then somewhere around an hour, hour and 15 minutes of time for other kinds of engagements. Some of which I think will be follow-up from previous lectures, so I always want to have at the beginning of the class a kind of open opportunity for 10 minutes or so for people to raise issues that they mulled about from the previous session. So we'll always begin with a kind of repetition, additional questions from you if there are any, from the previous class. And then various kinds of discussion formats which we can experiment with, given the size of the group. What I've usually done in the past is divide the discussion time roughly equally between randomly breaking down into groups of about six by counting off, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, well, 1, 2, 3, 4, I suppose, into groups of 5 or 6, and having sort of 20, 25 minutes of discussion in small groups and then reconvening for a big group discussion. That means that everybody will have a chance to talk easily and comfortably, particularly for those of you who, for whom there might be, at least at the beginning of the semester, some language issues. If you're a foreign, not native English speaker, and this is, and you've just arrived, although all of you seem to speak English clearly, still there's an habituation to the easy kind of conversation that occurs in a seminar. Everybody will have a chance to talk in those small groups. Sometimes those small groups will focus in on an issue they want to bring to the whole collective. And so I'll initially, when we reconvene, ask if there's any small group that wants to pose some problem for us collectively. So we'll do a lot of that. There's a kind of discussion which I just found out about that I've never tried before, and I'd like to try it as an experiment, just to see if it works, which it sounds a little gruesome, but it's called a fishbowl discussion. Have any of you been in fishbowl discussions? So the idea of a fishbowl discussion is, you can either do it randomly or not randomly, but let's suppose we do it randomly. That's the kind of fear and anxiety version, I suppose. But you randomly select six people. They sit in the middle of the class, and they discuss the material with each other, blocking us out. The rest of us watch and listen, take notes from the discussion. Now, we can either do it that way or we can get volunteers, so you can come to a class saying you really want to. Yeah?
You can also, another method of doing that is when you have the original group of six, and then when one of the group members think that they've said everything, another member from the outside ring can raise their hand and enter the group discussion.
Yeah, so we can try. So one thought I had is that we can just try some different experiments. Some of you have experience, so Joe has some experience with doing...
I'm the educator.
He's the educator. I would like to try some different formats for discussion. It's a problem to figure out, not just for pedagogy in a course, but for the world we want to create. If we're leftists, one of the things about the left is that you're in a hell of a lot of meetings. Oscar Wilde, this is a familiar quote, I think, to many of you. Oscar Wilde, the extraordinary English playwright of the early 20th century, late 19th century, once quipped that the only problem with socialism is that it takes up too many evenings. There is a very good book about the civil rights movement that says freedom is a constant meeting. The title of the book. And it is a problem. How do you run meetings? How do you have serious discussions which really push issues forward rather than are just platforms for ranting about positions? It's difficult. And I think treating the class as an experimental situation for trying different formats of discussion is one of the things we can do. So I'd like to try this fishbowl thing, and Joe can be our impresario since he has some educator experience with it. So that's basically how I plan to do the class. I will have my office hours across the street in the coffee house that's in the faculty club, which is just right in that building there, from 8:30 till just before this class. If there's enough demand, I can move it back to 8. I used to have it 8 to 10, but nobody ever showed up until 8:30, so... I'm happy to make it a longer period. I think it's a valuable thing to have the office hours dovetail with the class. But at the beginning of the semester, we'll start it at 8:30. So I'll come over here at about 5 to 10 if those of you who come here earlier could set up in this format, basically, so that the class is ready, I'd like to start really promptly at 10. You know, I think to do all these different things, to have the flexibility, to have good discussion, follow-up discussions, and so on, we should really give ourselves the full time. Yeah.
Are you flexible with out of office hour time?
Yeah, yeah.
I student teach every morning.
Sure. No, I those are just my set open office hours where people come in. But when I hold them there, everybody, if you come in, you see me with some students, just join the discussion. Don't hold back and wait till I'm done. The idea is that it's a way of going over particular readings or particular questions or talking about politics, whatever. It's a completely open forum before class on both days. I'm happy to make individual appointments. Especially having been on sabbatical the last year and having finished these actually two big writing projects, I feel rather liberated from pressure to finish other stuff I'm working on. So I'm totally devoting myself to teaching this semester and will be completely available as much as any of you want to. There have been years, for example, where a group of students in the class formed a study group outside of class where they wanted to have further discussion of the group, of the material, and I would come to that every other time or something to answer questions that they would have. And I'm happy to do that. So spontaneously, any subgroup of you want to form a study group. And in particular, there have been many years, not all, in which the undergraduates formed a kind of undergraduate caucus, so to speak. That is, where they would meet, and I, in fact, on several occasions, met every week with the undergraduates outside of class. We found a time where we could all meet. And I'd be happy to do that as well. But that, I'm leaving those initiatives to you. I'm not going to organize any of that. Okay, so we'll start promptly at 10. I'll be at the coffee shop in the faculty club at 8:30, and we can push that earlier if there's any of you who would like, if you're early-ish people and would like to be at 8, I'd be happy to do that. In terms of the ending time, the normal end time for a class in this time slot in the ordinary schedule is 10 to 12. That depends a little bit upon whether people have classes at 5 after 12, which is, I think, the next start time. Does anyone here have a 5 after 12 class? Okay, so we'll treat it as ending at 10 to 12, and sometimes it spills over a little with the discussion. Now, the other thing about scheduling the class is the end of the semester retreat, which I really hope this doesn't conflict with anybody's lives. You know, sometimes there are parents with young children and it becomes difficult, but in recent years, I've had the very end of the semester for this course be a retreat at a University of Wisconsin facility that's an hour north of here called Upham Woods. So what we do is we don't have classes the last week of the semester, but we do have this day and a half retreat at this wonderful facility in the woods on the Wisconsin River north of Madison. I will cover about half, it'll cost you about $25 room and board at this thing, maybe 20. I pay half of the cost. I haven't looked at what their fees are. That's usually ended up being about 20-ish for students. What the plan will be that on that weekend, that's where we'll most intensively discuss the problem of socialism and what I call real utopias as a kind of more encompassing term, of which socialism is a key component. That's the time that we will intensively talk about those things, the last block in the course. It will begin on Saturday morning, December, 12th. And it'll end at, we'll have a morning session on Sunday, so we'll have a morning session and an afternoon session on Saturday. We'll have a big party with a roaring fire and music, and I hope there's some musicians. I fiddle. We improvise drums by turning trash cans over. And are there any musicians here? Anybody who is comfortable jamming? Great. The more the better. And you don't have, you know, you can be incredibly amateurish. When you get enough people jamming together, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You don't even have to play in the right key. It sounds great. So we'll have an evening, that Saturday evening party. You're encouraged and certainly invited to have friends come as well, including for the whole weekend. It doesn't, you know, this is our event for us to discuss things we will, as a kind of culmination of the semester, and to discuss a set of readings that are targeted for that weekend. But I'm happy for other people to come along. If they do come and want to participate in the seminar part, you know, the discussions, then they should do the readings that we will, that will kind of anchor that discussion. They don't have to quickly skim the whole semester, just read that stuff. But it's fine for friends of yours who you think would be interesting to come along. And anybody from Madison and connected to any of your academic circles who wants to come to the party, of course, can come. There is also, this will be of particular interest for those of you who are not natives of either Wisconsin or the country. There is a wonderful old-fashioned country bar here up in the woods. It's a very funky, traditional, out-in-the-woods Wisconsin bar, which bizarrely introduced karaoke. So it shows the influence of Japanese culture in the depths of the Wisconsin woods. And what we have typically done in the at this evening event is the Saturday night is a potluck dinner, so you bring stuff that we will have as a collective potluck for that evening. We have our party with our music making, and then we walk to the bar, which is about a kilometer from the camp, from the retreat center, at around 10, and play pool, mix with the locals if they put up with us, till whatever, and then stagger back down the hill. December 12th is an uncertain time of the year climate-wise for those of you who are from here, so it can be reasonably pleasant. We could have a blizzard, so we'll see. Okay, so you should put that on your calendars. That's it's both fun, but it's also a real chance to then tie up the semester with a very intense and careful, unrushed, we won't have time constraints to follow up with things. It's also an occasion which any of you who are very experienced in these kinds of discussions, who have thought a lot about these issues, if you want to prepare presentations, sort of more extended interventions around these themes, we can discuss how that can be organized, and that's fine. The format will be very open and freewheeling for that weekend. All right. Any questions on any of what I've said so far? We'll organize, by the way, a car to get out to this place, Upham Woods, which is just north of Wisconsin Dells. We'll just organize carpools. It's never a problem to get people there. Now, on the written requirements, on the grading and the like. So, there are no tests in this exam, in this course. Different faculty have different views about the social control aspects of courses. I did early on attempt the kind of radical egalitarian solution of just saying, okay, everybody in the class gets an A, I'm not going to grade anything. That's too out of whack with the culture. And it's too out of whack with the real pressures that people are under. So the fact that particularly undergraduate students need good grades for various reasons that are not cynical, it's because it matters for things you might want to do, means that if you get an automatic grade in a course and then you have pressures from other courses, it's natural that the course that has the automatic grade gets shortchanged. So I don't do that anymore. But there's no exams. It means that if you wanted to, you could do relatively little work in this class. You know, I mean, I'm not going to test you to see if you read the lecture notes ahead of time. I'm not going to give pop quizzes. There's two papers and one other requirement, which I'll explain in a moment. So what you could really do is just read whatever you need to for those two papers. And the other requirement you could fake pretty effectively if you're good at that sort of thing. So, you know, this is just laying the cards on the table. You can get away with doing relatively little in this class. I think it would be stupid to take a class like this and do relatively little work. This is the kind of course where the more seriously you take it and give yourself the time to really read and think about the material, the more you're going to get out of it, because when we have these classroom debates, you're going to, even if you, for some topics, are more on the side, you're not feeling comfortable being in the thick of things, if you read carefully and thought about the stuff, you'll be able to learn a hell of a lot more from the discussions that we have. The biggest incentive I feel there is in a class like this for you to do a lot of work and to take it very seriously is how much you'll get out of it. For most of you, I know that's going to be sufficient motivation. You know, nobody really takes a class of this character just because it looks like an easy way of getting a grade and getting on with other things. So the written requirements are meant to enhance the learning process in the class, even though they also serve as the one occasion where I can do some evaluative monitoring. There are two short papers. The schedule for them is in the syllabus in the introduction, page 7. For the first paper, you'll have a chance to rewrite it in light of my comments, as long as you get it back to me before the second paper is due, and of course, if you, these are the deadlines. The deadlines are given for the papers. There's no reason, if you're going to write a paper on one of the readings we do in the first, you know, 7 or 8 classes, there's no reason to wait until the weekend before it's due to write a paper that's going to be anchored in a reading or a session early on in the semester. Write the paper at the time you're most engaged with that material, and then I'll read it as quickly as possible, and if you wanted to revise it, you'd have time to do it. So the first paper is due October 26th and covers the first half of the semester, and the second paper is due on the 9th and covers the second half of the semester. I don't put any particular constraints on these papers. They're not meant to be short-term papers. They're meant to be papers that directly engage one reading or a tight cluster of readings that are, you know, closely related to each other. But how you engage them, that's really up to you. Some people do it in the form of, you know, the kind of standard commentary on a text. Other people use an engagement with a particular set of readings as a way of setting the stage for an argument of their own on some historical question that they know about or related theoretical matters. I'm happy to discuss with you, of course, what you want to do, but you should feel relaxed about it. Because the idea is to really seriously engage one of the reading, core readings, or a cluster of related readings. The one guideline that I do pretty much insist on is that the papers not be mainly just exegesis, just summaries of what is in the readings. So roughly the way you should think about it is that if you were to write 10 pages, 2 or 2.5 pages of it can be summary. You do have to, after all, summarize the arguments you're going to engage, but no more than 25% of the paper should be exegetical. The rest should be engagement.
one sort or another. So those are the short papers. Now there's a new assignment which I, this is an experiment as well. I was thinking about what written assignment in the course would be the most useful in terms of building up a personal resource for you, particularly for those of, this is especially for those of you for whom this course fits into a intellectual agenda that extends beyond the confines of the course. I think it will be a useful exercise even for people for whom that's not true, but for graduate students especially, for whom engaging these ideas around the different themes of this class, this is just, for many of you, not the first time you've done it with many of these ideas, and for the rest of you, will not be the last time you will be encountering. And I thought the idea of each person constructing what I'm calling a personal handbook of ideas for an emancipatory social science, to give it a nice grandiose title, to create a handbook where for each of the key ideas and concepts that we are exploring, you create a you know, a file in your on your computer, and as you read things, you add and revise and modify that file. One way you can think of it is a way of organizing a semester's worth of notes, but in a special way. You're writing notes not on a reading, you're using a reading to add commentary and elements to a dictionary or a handbook of concepts. I haven't done this before in this class. I don't know if this is going to be, in the end, a huge burden that just completely overwhelms, or a really nice accompaniment to your work. So I want to have, we should have a lot of discussion as we go. You know, give me feedback about how this is going. We can modify this, we can figure out how to do this assignment. I've, on pages 7 and 8 of the syllabus, does anybody have a syllabus in front of I didn't print enough because, for those of you who came in late, so look on somebody else's right now. The syllabus is online, and I assume that a lot of you would have already printed it out. I didn't want to waste paper. I can, anyone who wants a syllabus who doesn't have one, tell me and I'll bring you more the next time. Or you can come to my office and I can give them to you later today. Anyway, I've given, this is how I thought about doing it, that we could, you could divide this handbook into three kind of big sections. One on meta-theoretical issues. So for example, the relationship between micro and macro analysis. That's a theme we're going to hit many times in the semester. It's going to be absolutely at the center of our discussion of ideology and consciousness, which is precisely about the formation of human subjects and subjectivity, beliefs, cognitive forms, and so on, about how human actors are formed as subjects, and how that relates to institutions and social structures. So the ideology section of the course is going to revolve around that problem, but it's going to figure in our analysis of class, it's going to figure in our analysis of the relationship of class and gender, which we'll have a discussion on, and many other things. So you can have an entry under your in your meta-theoretical issues part of your handbook on micro-macro. And as you read things where that comes up, you can put you can sort of organize your notes by putting them some commentary in that. And as you do so, then you create an entry which will have more or less organization. Some of them will be have more the character of just a series of excerpts from some of the readings, some quotations with a little bit of commentary. And then you might decide to write a few paragraphs to kind of bring that stuff together. Others can be little mini essays if you really think about a particular problem. I don't have strong expectations about what this is going to look like, and that's something we'll discover as we go. So the first one was meta-theoretical issues, and I've listed six examples of meta-theoretical issues. These are all things that I know are going to come up at various times. There's undoubtedly many others as well. The second type of entry would be about specific concepts.
that is a characteristic of this course. Some people, this resonates really well. Other people find that too much of the course is like reading a dictionary. Because I'm very concerned that the concepts we use in our sociological and theoretical work, that the terms, the concepts, be very clearly defined. Sometimes I probably worry about that issue too much, certainly on the concept of class, which I have spent several decades obsessing about. I probably am too preoccupied with the logical clarity and logical consistency of different aspects of a cluster of concepts. I want them all to fit together beautifully, elegantly. Theda Scotchpole, a well-known American sociologist, early, this was a long time ago, in a panel, accused me of packing my bags for a trip I never take. And the idea was that worrying about the words you use, the concepts, is sort of packing your bags. The trip is using them to explain things in the world. And she accused me, I think, both unfairly, but as in a lot of unfair criticisms, there's something right about the criticism. There's a kernel of truth, accusing me of obsessing too much about the logical status of all of my words. Nevertheless, it's a good way of organizing dictionaries, after all. The handbook is a kind of dictionary. So the second block in the handbook are various concepts. And again, I've just given some examples. These are all concepts we will certainly talk a lot about. But there are other concepts as well that you could do. One thing you could do if you wanted to, and particularly since this is our first experiment in this, you could go back to your computer and create a file with all of these labels, just so you have it organized that way. And then you can add and modify it as you go. You could treat this as a kind of opening template, and then change it from there. And finally, I think it would be interesting to have a section that is specifically on theoretical arguments or propositions, if you want to think of it that way, rather than just on the concepts. So the way I like to think about the problem of building theories is you first have to create concepts, and then you use the concepts to construct theories. Now, the reason why that's a misrepresentation or an incomplete representation is that in building the theories with your concepts, you transform the concepts themselves. So concepts get their meaning from the theories in which they function, but the theories can't be built without the concepts. So there is, to use a well-worn expression, a kind of dialectical relationship between concepts and theories. They mutually presuppose each other and transform each other. One way that concepts change is that they don't work very well in a particular theory. One way theories change is you've got some concepts and the theory doesn't work well with it. That's, in a way, how my concept of class has evolved over time in this sort of back and forth relationship to theory. And particularly that back and forth relationship in the context of trying to explain things in the world rather than just engage in logical constructions of a deductive sort. So I think it would be interesting to have a set of propositions well articulated as another kind of entry in your handbook. So this is an experiment. At the end of the semester, in terms of my feeling is I will evaluate these mainly on the kind of energy and good faith effort that's been put into them. So I should be able to see whether you've actually done the task in a serious way. But then I'd like you to, at the end of the semester, flag, I think I say four, I'm not sure how many I need. A number of these, let's say four of them. And you'll say, yes, I'd like you to read those four entries and give comments on them. So you'll direct me to which ones you feel are the most interesting or that you put the most time in or that you want the feedback on. Now, one final requirement of the class which I think is one of the most enjoyable requirements, is the co-mentoring groups that we will form. We'll do this next, at the second session we'll actually create these, because the number of students will settle down. We'll know exactly who we're dealing with by next Wednesday. The co-mentoring idea is particularly relevant for the undergraduates, that each undergraduate will be part of a co-mentoring group with, I guess given the ratios in this class, with two graduate students. So it's going to be groups of three. And the assignment is to meet outside of class for an hour a week at any time that you want to. And so these groups should be formed on the basis of roughly compatible schedules, or, you know, late night owls and early morning people should be in different groups, maybe. And the idea is then to have a very small group meeting where you meet outside of class, where you discuss whatever it is that you want to discuss about the course, in which the undergraduates have privileged standing in that co-mentoring group, that is, they can bring the questions to the table initially. And the graduate students then have the kind of responsibility of helping explain the material in light of whatever the questions are. Now, that way of framing it makes the assumption that the graduate students on average are more sophisticated on this material than the undergraduates. That's not always the case. There are some graduate students who have not encountered this material before. There are some undergraduates who have had years in the trenches of activism and just through osmosis have been exposed to a lot of these ideas. So there, you know, any graduate student who feels that they are undergraduate-ish, so to speak, with respect to this material, should without embarrassment declare in their co-mentoring group that they really feel they're part of that side of the equation. I call it co-mentoring, not mentoring, because in the end what happens is that everybody is helping everybody in this group. It's also a practical expression of the principle that the best way of learning something is to teach it, which will be true particularly for the graduate students, but also for the other graduate students. Now, the co-mentoring meetings are a real requirement. It's not just a casual thing which you can do or not do as you wish. This is a real requirement. The way the requirement is enforced, as it were, is that each week a short paragraph, just, you know, it can be very short, just say what you talked about, which I'm not going to grade, I'm just going to count, gets turned in to me, with your names on it. Occasionally, people have handed these things in without clear indication of who is actually involved in the discussion, and then my accounting system goes down. I like as much as possible for grades in the class to be determined by how much you do rather than by sheer brilliance, because I feel, generally speaking, people have more control over how hard they work rather than how much they, how sophisticated or how academic they are. And this is the case for this one. If you do this diligently, then you get full credit for it. If you don't, then that's a debit on the grading roster. Okay, I think we've now gone through all of the logistical issues. By the way, has anybody recently gone to, I haven't checked at Rainbow Books to see what books they have and what books they haven't. Alan Ruff, who runs the bookstore cooperative, has emailed me a couple of books that they were having trouble with, and then I sent everybody on the email list that information. Has anybody gone there recently just to see what the lay of the land is?
Yeah. They don't have the Origi and they don't have the Elster.
Yeah, so the Origi book is, the new edition of it is coming out. Giovanni Origi is he died last summer, a formidable, interesting, and wonderful person, just an incredibly interesting scholar on kind of the long sweep of capitalist history, focusing particularly on finance and what he calls financialization. we'll be using that towards the end of the semester as one of the examples of how you can take Marxian ideas and use them to have a theory of long historical trends rather than just existing conditions at a particular time. I thought it was good to read the new edition, which has an analysis of the current crisis in it as a coda to the book. And he finished it just before he died. The publisher told me it would be available by the end of the semester. So as we get further along towards that, I'll be keeping track of it, but I do think it should be available. I guess the Elster book is out of print. The publisher has an extremely expensive print-on-demand version available. I have put the chapters from the Elster book that are required readings on the course e-reserve website, so you don't have to buy it. I would, however, encourage particularly the graduate students for whom a course like this is an occasion to shore up your library, your permanent library of materials that will be resources for you, to get a used copy through one of the online bookstores. They should be reasonable in price. The Elster book is a book which some of you are going to hate. You know, he's a kind of sort of an analytical philosopher that likes to tear apart arguments in a particular way, and he has a particular bee in his bonnet with respect to Marx, which has to do with the weakness of what he calls the micro foundations of Marxist theory. I think the book is an incredibly valuable book because of its encyclopedic and comprehensive character for almost every topic in the Marxian canon. It's a very good resource, and even if you disagree with his interpretations, he's a wonderful person to argue with because he's so clear and systematic in his expositions. So I do think the book is worth getting, but not at $70 or whatever it is on the print on demand. But I think you can, for $15 or $20, there's used copies available online. And all the other ones are there? Good. Okay. One other thing. I don't believe in professors making money off of selling books that they've written by making them required for students. So I am going to reimburse you all for the royalties. They're not much. I'm not getting rich on my books, I have to tell you. But nevertheless, I get 10% royalties on books. I don't on used copies, so if you buy used copies, I won't reimburse you for that. But anybody who buys a new copy of any book I've written, I will reimburse you. So what I'll do is, at some point, I'll pass around a sheet, and you just write it down, and then I'll know how much to bring to pay you back for your... okay, that's all the requirements, as far as I know. Any questions on any of this? I think we should take a short break. And then I just had a few... Normally we're not going to spend an hour plus not talking about real material, obviously. That's just on this class. I'll just have a few comments I'd like to make about the subject matter that's in the readings for this week. This folds into the next week's discussion anyway. You should think of these first two classes as really a single session in a way. So we'll have more time for discussing the 2 weeks worth of work on next Wednesday's class. Okay, well, let's take a break. Let's reconvene at 15:15. Okay?